Coming up on Boston Public Radio, a new CNN poll says America just doesn't trust Barack Obama. We'll ask CNN's John King if immigration reform or a repaired website may be the road back for the president. Then an official report is out on the killing of 26 at Sandy Hook almost a year ago with mental health problems at the core. Is there anything we can do? And you heard those ads for a huge selling drug which deal with all the woes that low testosterone allegedly causes? Medical ethicist Art Kaplan says there just may be a problem here.
Open mic with Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane on resentment against techie billionaires changing the world. Then barbecue master Stephen Reichlin on brining and barbecuing your turkey. And Jim Browdy on tips and how not to gain 20 pounds this Thanksgiving. All that's coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
There was a couple of snowflakes. I almost stayed home. It was a 50-50 proposition for me, Marjorie. So if Barack Obama wants to enjoy Thanksgiving, I'd suggest he not read a new CNN poll. Will the Iran deal help him out or dig a deeper hole? Maybe it's immigration reform or maybe just a website which actually works in 4 days. Joining us to go over all this and more is John King. He is CNN's chief national correspondent. Hello there, John.
Happy Tuesday before Thanksgiving. Maybe while he's at DreamWorks, they can do an animated or some sort of a movie President Obama.
With a different ending, right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, tell us about this new CNN poll, John. I mean, it is pretty depressing for the president. I didn't realize things had gotten this bad.
Well, what has happened, if you study it closely, I mean, Republicans are going to do handstands over this poll, but if you study it closely, what essentially has happened is we've gone back to normal in the sense that, remember, right after the shutdown, we were talking about this. You know, Democrats had their little dreams of, you know, Speaker Nancy Pelosi coming back and not only holding but maybe building on their Senate majority, because right after the shutdown, more people blamed the Republicans in Congress, which, of course, made perfect sense because the Republicans in Congress were more to blame for the government shutdown. But the air is now out of that balloon, and mostly because of the rollout of the Obamacare, also just because of continuing sluggishness in the economy. You know, people think the economy is okay, but nobody thinks it's good or great. That now they favor Republicans just slightly when they ask, who would you vote for Congress next year, that generic so-called ballot question. But the Democrats had an 8-point edge just a month ago, and that was the shutdown. That's gone away. And so if you look at it now, look, the election's not until next November, but traditionally, in the six-year itch, meaning the second term midterm election, the president's party loses 19 seats in the House. So this is a more normal political environment, and a normal political environment will mean Republican gains.
But I guess what I'm surprised at, John King, is the sort of personal distrust of Barack Obama, not thinking he's honest, not thinking he's trustworthy. That's more than half the people. And 4 out of 10 don't think he can manage the federal government. Only four out of ten think he can manage the federal government. So they're really attacking his competence and his honesty.
Yeah, and we've talked a bit about this, and, you know, people get mad when you make the Katrina comparison, and I'm not comparing Obamacare to Hurricane Katrina, but I'm comparing how the voters reacted to President Obama to how they reacted to George W. Bush, in the sense that you have that double whammy, the combination of, you know, the guy can't run the government, and especially when you're a Democrat, that hurts you, because you're the guy who's supposed to be, you know, pro-government. Your party says we need to use the levers of government to help people. So when people start to think you can't manage the government, and you're a progressive Democrat saying give the government more power, you're in trouble. It's a hard argument to make. And number two, the credibility on the honesty and trustworthiness, it makes it very hard to recover. So you take those two things. You know, the president's credibility is down, his confidence is down. With that, his approval rating is down. And now Democrats see they're losing on the congressional ballot. You guys have been around enough politicians. You know what any Democrat in trouble on Capitol Hill is going to do now if that website is not near perfect by next week like they promised, the Obamacare website. They're going to start treating the president as a pinata, even though he's in their party. That's how it goes.
So what is the deal with the website, as best you can tell? What do we have, 4 days on one of those CNN countdown things? We have 4 days till it's supposed to be what, accommodating 80% of the people who go on it? Are they close? What's the word?
If we start a countdown clock on the website, I may just in a kayak and try to throw my way off to Boston or something, get there in time for them. They say that, you know, they're hoping that, you know, 4 out of 5 users should have a near flawless experience by then. Although, you know, it was down just again yesterday morning for a while. So we're going to see what happens here. And I think that, again, you don't need me to tell you to be skeptical. The president himself says, you know, I'm a little skeptical when they tell me this thing's going to be ready. But they promised to have it mostly ready. And again, I think that's another deadline because they laid it out there that if you're a Democrat on the ballot who is at all nervous about next year and that's another bad day, you're not going to say, oh, Mr. President, we'll give you another week. Oh, deal with this internally. You're going to say it's time for Congress to pass something because they're going to want to go home, you know, thumping their chest saying, you know, we made the president fix this.
Well, you do hear more good stories about the Affordable Care Act, particularly out of California, where they have the state exchange. And California, obviously, is a huge place. So you say to yourself, well, if they can get it to work reasonably well in California, which apparently they're doing, then they can transfer this to the whole country. So I'm wondering if sort of, you know, it's going to get better. And when it gets better, that we're going to get off this constant bashing and people's attitude is going to change. I mean, they do have some good health plans out there that are cheaper and more comprehensive.
That is the president's great hope that, you know, 6 months from now, 8 months from now, people look back and sure they remember, you know, they got a couple flats out of the box, but they actually still like their new car. Their new car is actually pretty cool. And it costs them a little bit less than they thought, or it has better options than their last car had. And that is what the president's hoping in the long view. And he may well be right. The problem is if those credibility numbers and honesty numbers, you know, if that starts to turn into cement, even if he has a good news story to tell or a better news story to tell 6 months from now, you know, can he repair the damage that is done in the short term? Look, there's nothing in politics like, you know, panic. And when Bush could get nothing done in his second term because after Katrina and Iraq war on popularity hit a high point, his own party just abandoned him, and of course the Democrats weren't going to help him out. If the president's party abandons him, of course the Republicans aren't going to help him out. And so then by next spring, he might be saying, I told you so, and you know everyone's going to be looking at him saying, yeah, well, we're still not sure we're going to attach ourselves to this trailer. But that is the question in the long term. And you mentioned, you know, these states that are doing well. I mean, you know, I don't give advice that often, but maybe the Obama administration should fly in the insurance commissioners and the IT people from those states and say, help us. What did you do?
Well, you don't give advice often. I give it all the time, usually wrong. I'm going to give him one more piece of advice. He should hire this 80-year-old guy we had in the studio yesterday who sold the Affordable Care Act better than Barack Obama has in 3 years. That would be Michael Dukakis, who really, you know, when he was done his pitch, and I know you covered him and quite extensively when you're back here in New England, but he really marketed this thing, which I still feel that the president is coming up a little short. In any case, you know, we used to do it.
Well, we went through this, remember, in the last campaign, and you were saying the same thing about Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
What does that tell you? Governors who have experience turning policy into programs and turning speed bumps, you know, into solutions as opposed to speed bumps into ditches. The guys with governing experience, and that, again, that's been one of the criticisms of this president, is that sometimes, you know, he's never done that part. And he's 5 years in now, so you can't use it as an excuse anymore. But the guys who explain policy into programs better and politics into programs better are the governors. There's no question. That's why George W. Bush went to the Republican governor's meeting the other day and said, we'd be smart to nominate a governor.
He was pretty funny on Jay Leno, too, last week. Hey, John, we used to ask you for a weekly immigration update, but we stopped when it was pretty clear nothing was going to happen, at least in the immediate future. But since we last spoke to you, a bunch of leading Republicans are saying, maybe we're going to do this thing. A poll came out. I was stunned with these numbers, not yours, the Religious Public Policy Institute or something. 63% of Americans support a pathway to citizenship for people here illegally. Is this going to rear its head again in a real way, or is that a pipe dream?
I think it's a pipe dream on that part, the path to citizenship. You know, the president has tried to nudge this forward by saying he would now do this in pieces. You know, he's been saying forever he wants a comprehensive sweeping bill, and you know, there's a reason for that, just like health care. You're not going to get some of the more controversial things if you do it piece by piece. If you do a little border security, if you do a little, you know, Dream Act version for younger immigrants, if you do a new guest worker program, if you do maybe, you know, a high-tech visa program, most of those things are pretty popular, and you could get, you know, 80 votes in the Senate and a clear majority in the House. But then you come to the, what about the 11 million? And is it a path to status? Is it a path to citizenship? And so if you don't have a sweeping bill, the hard stuff tends not to get done. But the president has said to get something done, he's open to doing it in pieces. But John Boehner has said that it's not happening this year. There's a lot of pressure from the business community on the Republicans. It will be interesting to see. Part of the calculation is this, is that they want to see how low the president goes and then try to do something next year proactively from a Republican standpoint. And they believe if the president is low, that he'll have no choice but to come their way some. I think I understand that. I understand that politically, the leverage argument there. I do think Republicans, whether it's next year, or the year after, or the cycle after that, if they don't proactively try to do something about this, you know, they're I've talked about the president being in quicksand right now. The Republicans are in really deep quicksand, if not cement, with Latino voters around this country. And if they don't come forward with an actual plan soon, as opposed to reacting all the time or saying no all the time, I do think they have the run the risk of locking this in, you know, for a generation or more. And if you look at the demographic changes in America, you lock that in, it is really hard to win at the national level.
We're talking with John King, chief national correspondent of CNN. John, I was seeing this all over CNN, actually, this Sunday, I think it was. Mark Zuckerberg, founder of Facebook, running around embracing immigration reform from his perspective because we are losing all these really brilliant programmers and techie types because they can't stay in the United States to work after they get out of MIT or Stanford or wherever they're going to school. And I wondered, maybe that is, it's not going to solve the whole problem, but you wonder what is coming from a different front. If the tech world and people like Zuckerberg are hammering this theme, maybe that gets some action going. They think they can change the world, those guys. We're talking about this actually a little bit later in the show.
I think the more ideas come from outside of Washington and outside of people with political titles, especially given how disgusted people are with, you know, the Congress and not happy with the president right now, that is helpful. When you have a leading, you know, businessman, a leading young businessman, a self-made bazillionaire saying, you know, we need this. But again, to that point, you know, if you want to talk about allowing students with certain, whether it's medical degrees or technology expertise or some other, you know, math and science expertise, you'd get probably, you know, 98 votes in the Senate and 420 in the House if you put just that one bill up. The problem is the president's friends would say, Mr. President, you know, don't do it that way because we need the pathway to citizenship. So there's two separate arguments there. In terms of a smarter visa program, a smarter how do we deal with these students program, how do you let people, you know, earn citizenship by going into medical school or programming school, that's a no-brainer politically. The problem is the political system. I always say, you know, why don't we do incremental everything? Incremental everything, you could actually build some confidence by getting stuff done. And on a bill like that would pass in a heartbeat. The problem is the interest groups that want to pass the citizenship would throw themselves in the way saying, don't do it, because if you start passing the popular pieces, then you've got no train to attach the unpopular piece to.
Yeah, speaking of standing in the way of things, the filibuster vote, which seems like it was a century ago, was just last week. You know, theoretically, the notion was Democrats are going to pay a price, whatever that means. And obviously, they were talking longer term about the Republicans taking control of the Senate again. In short term, what is the bad feeling generated by the 52-48 vote, John King, mean for the ability of people who don't work together so well anyway, working together on anything?
Well, you asked the question out of a conversation about immigration reform. You know, John McCain is one of the people who says this poisons the well. He's one of the people that's critical to trying to get something done big on immigration reform. And so, you know, part of this is, you know, I always call the town I work a daycare center, and daycare centers everywhere will sue me. But, you know, part of it is, you know, get over it, Senator. You know, okay, so you're fighting about nominees and you're fighting about the rules, but now the question is immigration policy. Just vote your heart. You know, vote the policy. Can't they do that? They should be able to do that. One would hope that they could put, you know, other grudges and other fights aside, especially when it's a big, huge, you know, important generational and economic issue for the country. But when you have, you know, three or four or five or six senators saying the well is poisoned, and you have a House Speaker who says, I'm not doing a big immigration bill, it does have an impact. It just does. Plus, we have this thing called the calendar. You know, I'm about to say Happy Thanksgiving to everybody. Guess what? They're not going to do much more in 2014. The biggest thing they have to try to do is reach some kind of a budget agreement. I mean, 2013, I mean. And then we're in 2014, and that's an election year, and we have to reset all the political calculations and restudy the polls and, you know, see who wants to cooperate with whom or not.
It is pathetic. I mean, it is. You know, one last thing on filibuster. I'm getting such a headache from this. And then we're going to move to foreign affairs, which we don't often talk to you about. The Hill wrote a piece the other day. I don't know if others in your craft are saying the same thing. that one of the positives, well, it's a poor choice of words, one of the likely outcomes or possible outcomes of this filibuster change is that it makes it more likely that the president would relieve Kathleen Sebelius of her duties, the argument goes, because it'd be easier to have a new head of HHS, Health and Human Services, confirmed. Is that ridiculous, or is that somewhere near reality?
No, I think that's a possibility. I don't read minds, and I know Secretary Sebelius is proud and stubborn. She wants to stay. I know the president has been reluctant to give the Republicans, you know, to throw meat to the sharks when they're demanding it and circling the boat. He'd prefer that they sort of swim away a little bit, and then he might do it. Look, also, let's forget the details of Obamacare and how, you know, she is accountable. It's not her fault. It's people in her department, but she's the CEO of that department, so she's accountable for it. She's also been here 5+ years, and, you know, there was no expectation that she was going to stay 8. She wanted to get this program off the ground, and she wanted to go. So I do think it makes it more reasonable that in a couple of months, you know, come Easter of the next year, she could say, you know, okay, it's been 6 years, it's time for me to go, thank you very much, and everyone else says he's thrown her under the bus or he's thrown her off the boat, and we can have that debate, but she moves on. I do think that when it comes to these, I think the key for the president here and for the long-term question about how much does this poison the well, and what would the Republicans do if they won the majority in the next election or the one after that, is how many times the president uses this. He wants those 3 judges for the District Court of Appeals here in D.C. That's a, you know, breeding ground for the Supreme Court. He wants his Homeland Security Secretary. He wants Janet Yellen confirmed. If he stops at 5 or 6 and the Democrats don't push it and sort of rub it in the Republicans' face, then I think this, you know, could be not forgotten, but not it won't be a flashing red light all the time. If he just decides, you know, let's bring 25 people to the floor and ram it down their throats, then, you know, guess what? If Mitch McConnell becomes majority leader January 2015, you think he's just going to say, oh, forget about it? I don't think so.
We're talking with John King from CNN. John, let's just talk for a second here about Iran. You know, our Secretary of State, who our former senator here in Massachusetts, John Kerry, is getting a lot of criticism for the deal that Obama and others negotiated to kind of slow the nuclear power program in Iran. Israeli's Prime Minister Netanyahu apparently was very, very upset, and we all know, yelled at Obama, and they had a tough conversation. What's the political assessment of this? Did we not get enough? Israel's in a tough position, obviously, but what's the smart thinking in D.C. about this deal with Iran?
You know, most of the technical think tank types have worked on this issue for years, say this is the best deal you are going to get right now. And so the president had to decide, do you try to make a down payment here by making a lot of people mad, and a lot of important people mad, like the Israelis, like the Saudis, like your own Democratic chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Menendez of New Jersey, like Chuck Schumer, member of the Democratic leadership in the Senate and, you know, from New York, not just the conservative Republicans yelling about this. Do you take a chance? Do you give Iran something, a slight easing of the sanctions, in exchange for essentially a promise to do this? They don't give up much here. And so that's why Prime Minister Netanyahu is mad. That's why the conservatives are mad. The president didn't get much here beyond a freeze. So he gets a freeze and a couple of adjustments. The Iranians get an easing of some sanctions. And Prime Minister Netanyahu's bet is, you know, you're being played, Mr. President. They're going to, you know, get their economy back on footing once you release these sanctions. Maybe they'll even agree to another agreement, and you'll ease more sanctions. And then, you know, a year in, the inspectors will get kicked out, or they won't allow access to this or that facility. That's his bet. The president's bet is, well, if I walk away now, Iran gets a nuclear weapon. We have no deal. So let's try this. And the president's promise is that if it doesn't work, he'll be the first one to say, okay, my bad, let's ratchet the sanctions up again. So you can understand the intellectual arguments behind both approaches. The question here is, you know, this is really how this plays out and what happens to the Israeli-U.S. relationship, what happens to the president's, you know, selling this foreign policy at home, really depends on Iran. Are they serious or are they bluffing? And we're not going to know the answer to that question for a while.
Let's visit one last country before we let you go, John. I was going to say stunned, but I guess I shouldn't be in light of the fact that there has been a continual lack of attention, at least in my opinion, in Congress on what goes on in Afghanistan. Apparently, we're now pressuring Karzai, one of the most corrupt leaders in the world, and I guess our friend in quotes, to immediately sign this deal, which he would like to not sign until the spring, until I guess there's a new parliament or something, which would cause there to be 12,000 troops staying beyond what I thought was the end of our combat connection there in Afghanistan. Is anybody in Congress up in arms about this, or is this just business as usual? When I say this, I mean the continued presence of these 12,000 troops.
Well, they have always said they want to keep a small residual force there. Whether you consider 12,000 small or not, I guess, is a subject of a worthy debate. Is everyone up in arms here? Yes, there's a lot of people up in arms, but the primary question here is, look, we've been at this a while. Remember, it was early in the Bush administration, early after 9/11, that they essentially put Karzai in power. And I guess he's the lesser of all evils over there is the calculation, so we have to keep dealing with this guy. But he negotiates agreements, and then everybody nods and shakes hands, and the minute the United States gets out of the room, he says, plus this. How about that? This is like your kids at Christmas, well, ladies and gentlemen. You know, you're just never going to make them happy. They're going to keep coming back with the list. And he's viewed as unpredictable, unstable, unreliable. And by unstable, I mean they think mental health issues. And so part of the deal is, you know, a lot of people now think Karzai negotiated and said he was on the verge of signing, and now he's adding these other circumstances that he's trying to force the administration to walk away and leave nobody there. Now, that's what happened in Iraq. And that would make the liberals happy. There are a lot of conservatives and a lot of more neutral people who would say, you know, would we have a little more influence in Iraq if we had 8,000 or 10,000 troops there? Would it matter? Do we want to do this in Afghanistan, walk away, and in 10 years say, oh, boy, the Taliban came back. Oh, boy, Al-Qaeda's established a little, you know, nook and cranny up here. Some of this policy-wise is above my pay grade, but this is a relationship that has started, you know, way back in the Bush administration and all of the Obama administration. It is hundreds of millions and billions of dollars in U.S. money into this guy Karzai. And, you know, he's as trustworthy as Peyton Manning and the Colts.
Well, speaking of that, boy, you are the master of the segue. Raise your right hand and tell us whether you turned the television off when it was 24-0 at halftime.
No, sir. Are you crazy? If you could read my text to my son, they were not positive reviews of the team that calls themselves the Patriots. But no, I opened another beer. I took a deep breath and I sat there and watched. And then suddenly things got beautiful, didn't it?
They got truly beautiful. Yes, they did, for Belichick and the boys.
Hey, John, hope you have a lovely Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving,
hope you get the
John.
Day off.
I'm going to try to take the day off. Happy Thanksgiving to both of you and all your folks there. And everybody out there listening, and let's hope this is a down payment for the Patriots. It was a little shaky the week before.
Listen to this guy. Talk to you next week, John. Thanks.
I might
so
need
much.
A job someday, Jim.
That's right. That's right. John King is CNN's chief national correspondent. It always, as always, John, great to talk to you. When we come back, we're going to look at the results that came out of the Newtown report just yesterday. Could anything have been done to prevent Adam Lanza from killing 26 people, all those children, and himself? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
So, you've got your stuffing, mashed potatoes, and of course the turkey and all kinds of pies. But after that, good conversation is yet another essential element around any Thanksgiving table. This week on Thursday and Friday afternoon, we hope you'll enjoy back-to-back episodes of Here's the Thing. Alec Baldwin talks with actors and comedians and musicians about what got them going for their life's work. Happy Thanksgiving from all of us here at 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you
and Newbridge on the Charles in Dedham, a vibrant senior community offering residents a bridge to a meaningful retirement. You can learn more or schedule a tour at experiencenewbridge.org. That's experiencenewbridge.org. And Subaru of New England, offering the new Subaru Forester with symmetrical all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at subaruofnewengland.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Yesterday, Connecticut State's attorney released a 48-page report of the Newtown shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary that happened almost a year ago. I think it was December 14th. There are new details on Adam Lanza, on his mother Nancy Lanza, on how the two lived. There are also more details on what Lanza, meaning Adam Lanza, did the day he shot and killed 26 people. What isn't clear is if anything could have been done to save Lanza from his violent impulses and in turn save the 26 people and his mother from him. Our number is 877-301-8970. What we want to talk to you about is the headline, or at least the story we hear after virtually every mass shooting, that the shooter was suffering from serious mental health problems. We discuss this every time. We discuss whether or not it was preventable. Were there signs? Could people have done anything to rescue the shooter from himself and rescue his victims from him? And we want to know what your sense is on this, how we fix this mental health conundrum, for lack of a better expression, and hopefully save lots of lives. 877-301-8970. You wrote a great piece today about the report out of Connecticut, Marjorie.
Thank you. Well, as you just said, Jim, there was a very familiar pattern here, and the pattern is significant mental health problems that aren't addressed. Adam Lanza, mental health therapist, recommended that he take medication. He didn't do it. They recommended that he go into behavioral treatment. He didn't do it. The one thing that's different about this case is his mother, his first victim, and we have no idea why she did this. She was shot in the head before he went off to the Sandy Hook schoolhouse, supplied him with a lot of weapons. She bought them legally. She bought the ammunition. Apparently the house, not only were there many guns in there, but there were also things like swords and these really dangerous knives and everything else.
Well, she thought, we read earlier, prior to this report, this is what it was going to allow them to bond, to go to shooting ranges,
right,
or this weaponry.
But you learned from this report yesterday that this young man had serious problems. Back in the seventh grade, a teacher noticed that his schoolwork was scarily violent. In the fifth grade, he produced this really weird book about a grandmother shooting people, including children. His room, which she was not allowed, the mother was not allowed to go into, we now know had this spreadsheet of school shootings dating back to 1891. He was obsessed with Columbine, the more recent one in the 90s. He was obsessed with that 2006 Amish school shooting when those young children were killed. He was obsessed with playing this video game that was about school shootings. And in the weeks before the murders in Newtown, he was communicating with his mother, even though they lived in the same house, only via email. She never introduced him to friends. They knew that she had a son, even though his father, the parents were divorced, the divorced father over and over tried to get in touch with him. The kid wouldn't respond after the age of 18, and he had nothing to do with his older brother, with whom he'd been very close before. So all the signs were there, refused to take the medication, and yet nothing happened. And again, you go back to these other terrible shootings, the Jared Loughner, the Gabby Gifford shooter, yeah. Same thing. His parents knew he had serious problems. He had two hospitalizations, stopped taking his medicine. James Holmes, the Aurora, Colorado shooter, again, the psychiatrist treating him warned the school that he was dangerous. He cut off his psychiatric care. So it's over and over.
Yeah, but you
and over.
Can you think of a major American problem issue where we know what the problem is? And forget that you can't get a solution through Congress or anything. People don't even have a solution. I mean, there are privacy rights on one hand. There is voluntary versus involuntary commitment on the other. There's the question of what should be the standard. Obviously, we want people to see shrinks if they think they need mental health treatment. We want the stigma to disappear. Should just seeing a shrink be something that triggers something for getting a firearm license? The point I'm trying to make is there's a common thread through so much of this, yet everybody is, and I don't have an answer, is completely helpless. And we want to know if you think you have an answer about how we deal with this epidemic of mental health issues that seems to run through most, if not all, of these mass shootings. And we all wring our hands afterwards, talk about prevention. Could we have done anything? We need more mental health treatment. We know all this sort of stuff. But virtually nothing happens. Our number is 877-301-8970.
Well, meanwhile, we have the front page of the Globe and the Herald talking about today this closing of this mental health facility in Brookline because of a history of bad treatment. We have the stories over and over again about how adolescents, it's nearly impossible to get good treatment. It's very, very expensive. A lot of therapists will not take insurance. So unless you are wealthy, you can't even afford to go in and get that treatment.
One of the crimes, by the way, just as a small thing, I don't want you to fly over that. The notion that so many therapists are allowed to not take insurance, which essentially the whole agenda, and they may deny it, is to screen out, as you say, lower income people.
Yeah.
Because by definition, you can't front the money. They'll say, well, you can just submit the claim to the insurance company.
You can't do
it. Well, that's after you've paid $800 a month for four visits. It is the fact that that is allowed by law to me. We should discuss that with the governor when he comes back later next month.
Well, here's another problem in the law. I know everyone wants to keep their medical records private, and everyone understands why. But in this Adam Lanza case, we learned again that he was like a tabula rasa. What's that expression? Clean slate is what I mean to say. When he got to high school, that even though his elementary school teachers had seen difficulties, when he got to high school, the teachers there did not know about those difficulties because they were kept private. The privacy thing. We've just gone crazy over the privacy
thing. Yeah, but there's a flip side. There's a flip side about if people don't have. I'm not arguing against you, except to say if people aren't sure that there is a certain level of privacy, that's yet another reason not to seek treatment. I mean, I am surely not saying it's easy, but the fact that we know what the problem is and there is virtually no attempt to solve it is, to me, it is a national crime. Let's go to Tyler in the car. You're first on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hi, Tyler.
Hey, good afternoon. I just want to talk about, I think Jim was talking about how awful the stigma is. I mean, I've seen a therapist off and on for depression for a couple of years, and after this Newtown shooting, people seriously would say, like, well, now since you see someone, we know you're not going to do that, too. But it's just a huge stigma. If my kid wants to, like, get tracked by the school or whatever, like, there's just a huge stigma that people will not see a therapist, or that people think that you're crazy if you do.
Well, you know, by the way, this is one area, even though he's the subject of a lot of criticism. Barack Obama's tried to do something. Mm-hmm. Tipper Gore, Al Gore's wife, tried to do something. The notion that there's this, and a lot of people who care deeply about men and women who come back from wars, who, again, you've heard the line a million times, a broken arm, they can see, it's fine to talk about, but you can't talk about the damage that's been done inside your head because in some fashion you're not as strong and good a person. It is pathetic, Tyler, and you described the situation perfectly. Thanks for the call.
But I do think, without sounding like too much of a Pollyanna, it's changing. And the reason it's changing is because you read statistics about a quarter of kids going into colleges in the United States of America are on some sort of medicine, either an antidepressant, anti-anxiety. So if everybody is taking something, if we are indeed
of young people report, or self-report, I guess it is, they're suffering from some sort of depression. Of that one quarter, what percentage get treated?
Six or
7%.
You know, what always kills me, there's some terrible thing that happens in a suburban school and they rush in with all the therapists to help these kids. If you live in the inner city of America, anywhere, you know, you know your cousin's been shot, your cousin's in jail, your brother-in-law is shot. You know all this violence all the time. And because they're poor, they don't get that kind
of treatment. Well, what's a great book, decades old now, by Jonathan Kozol, local guy, Savage Inequality.
Yeah.
Savage Inequality in the schools on virtually every single level. You know, I don't want to be Pollyanna either, but Polly Jim, since you brought it up. This is one of the few areas around gun issues where, at least in the abstract, Republicans and Democrats agree in the wake of all these shootings. There's got to be something, whatever that means, done on the mental health front. What is that something? Where's that debate? Where's the proposal? Where's
anything?
It's expensive.
Anything? It's very expensive. We're supposedly going to get more parity on mental health illness through the Affordable Care Act, which, of course, as everybody knows, is in limbo. But what's really sad is that, as people know, and you know in your own lives, treatment works in a lot of cases. I mean, there are these great drugs, not you want to be on drugs the rest of your life, but a lot of these drugs really do work. Talk therapy really does work. You can be treated and get better. And it's really sad that so many people aren't not able to get that.
But when you read I'm sorry, I know you read the – we'll get back to Coles in a second. I know you read the report.
Yeah, he wouldn't take his medicine.
What do you do with somebody who, at that age, apparently his father knew he was not in touch. What did you say? It was 2 years. Same with his brother. His mother apparently was, I wouldn't say happy with it, but content enough because she was hoping that through this weaponry they'd bond. If he doesn't seek it, what power do people around him have to force him to seek it? And in these cases, they apparently didn't want to try to force him anyway.
I think the commitment laws are different in every state. But one of the things that's very perplexing about the Lanza case is the mother, the teachers, the therapists no one saw this coming. He didn't talk about doing these things.
You said that, but some of the things in the earlier grades, there were horribly violent images.
Right. But again, you know, you have these stories in the news all the time of it. Some kid in sixth grade draws a gun and he brings it to school and he gets in trouble and everybody makes fun of it. Now, I'm not saying that because you drew a gun, you're going to go out and start shooting people. But, you know,
I'm not suggesting based on those violent images that they thought he was going to go kill 27 people either.
They didn't go, thank you. But
there were signs of something.
Well, the signs were in his bedroom. I mean, he had spreadsheets on mass murders. His mother wasn't allowed in there. Supposedly, you wonder if she saw them, if she might think he was more dangerous. But apparently, she did not think he was dangerous at all. Let's go to Michelle in the car. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Love your show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And I think that one thing, well, a couple of things. One is, I think it's very difficult for parents to admit that this could possibly happen to my child, that this could possibly be my kid.
Yeah.
And I know I wouldn't want to admit it either, but kind of seeing the symptoms for what they are. And when you talk about accountability, it's kind of staying on top of it. And I know that this young man was not a kid, but if my daughter was living in my home, she would not lock the door against me. You know what I mean? Like, that just would not be allowed, because he has symptoms. He has issues. Medication is critical. So I think that it's kind of, you know, and another question or issue is that sometimes psychiatrists or certain, depending on who you're working with, not everybody is truly trained or very well trained on psychiatric drugs.
Right.
Like some, you know, you really need to go to a psychiatrist, and obviously if they're working with therapists, but what kind of a doctor were they working with? If it's a general practitioner or if it's your primary care physician, they're not going to know what kind of drugs to administer to you. You need to go to someone who really specializes in that type of science and therapy that will
takes insurance, as Marjorie mentioned earlier, or if you're even a middle-class kid, you can't afford to go to that sort of person. Michelle, you raise a great point about denial, because obviously this mother was in denial. She kept supplying all these weapons because she thought that it was going to create some sort of relationship with a 20-year-old son with whom she had very little. Michelle, thanks for the call.
Well, there were also these other things that he did that were so odd. You know, she talked about, in this report talked about how she had to do laundry over and over and over again, because even though he would only talk to her via email, which isn't, of course, talking at all, he wanted her to do his laundry all the time because he obsessively changed his clothes all the time because he was a germaphobe.
Germaphobe, yeah.
And an entire box of Kleenex in a day because he would only open door handles with Kleenex over his hands and had to have food prepared in a certain way and couldn't have things mix on the plate. He had a lot of obsessive compulsive things, and that doesn't obviously mean you're a dangerous person, but she certainly knew that he had big time issues, let's put it that way. And the classic, he had no friends. So anyway, Peter in the car, what do you think, Peter?
Hi, I unfortunately think that there is no solution in the short term. I'm a shining example, 52 years old, only diagnosed as bipolar within the past year. Was manic depressive for 30 years with a firearms license to carry concealed since I was 18. Tragedy could have struck. The only question that's asked when you go for a renewal is if you have been inpatient hospitalized. But I honestly don't think there is an answer unless in the long term we start looking at psychiatric illnesses. Mental health is really being neurologically based, and realizing that the real need for 80% of the cases is for patients to really see a psychiatrist and get on medications first.
Yeah, that's a great point about the ability to get the firearm weapons. That's a great point, Peter. Thank you.
And the question about whether there are questions that are not terribly intrusive but go further than just whether or not you've been committed, which is, I think, is that the standard in Massachusetts?
I believe it is. I don't know what the standard is in Massachusetts.
The number is 877-301-8970. There were very few comments yesterday out of the families of the 20 kids who were killed, which is totally understandable. But the governor, did you hear Governor Malloy yesterday said once again that if this is a time for Congress to act and do something, he didn't mention gun control specifically. But, you know, it's also talking about our conversation with John King and how depressing some of that is. The fact that nothing, you know, forget if you're not a whole nine yard kind of person on gun control. The fact that we did not even get background checks, even as a symbolic step forward out of what happened in Newtown is staggering. Even that compromise that Manchin-Toomey compromised, Joe Manchin, the moderate Democrat from West Virginia, Toomey, the Republican from Pennsylvania, which was sort of a half-assed background check thing, at least it would have said on the part of Congress, we hear you, even if it wouldn't have prevented all the things we'd like prevented. It's frightening.
And you look at the list of the guns that we know about that he had, the Bushmaster semi-automatic rifle.
Which is what he used on everybody, yeah, right? Wasn't that what he used in the school?
Yes, that's what he used in the school. The Glock 10 millimeter. By the way, when I went to the gun show up in New Hampshire, without any license or anything else you could buy, with no questions asked, you could buy a Bushmaster semi-automatic rifle.
That's why you need federal gun control.
Glock 10 millimeter semi-automatic pistol, Sig Sauer 9 millimeter semi-automatic. They were all found near his body. He had another semi-automatic a shotgun next to his car, and back home he killed his mother with a Savage Mark II rifle. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And then there was spears and swords and everything else all around the house. You do have to. I don't want to blame this mother because she was his first victim, but you do have to wonder what she was thinking. I just don't know.
The whole culture has got to change. The first caller said it perfectly. There is a stigma, despite the efforts of Obama and the Tipper Gores and those who are fighting for veterans who come back with PTSD. But the reality is the stigma is still there on all levels, not to mention the fact that most poor and middle-class people can't afford to see a therapist. Let's go to Mary in Providence. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Mary.
Hi. I am a psychiatric nurse, and I and many other people in the profession, as well as the patients, our clients, are very offended by the common misperception that is so often reinforced by the media that all mentally ill people are potentially violent. Mentally ill people, 10 to 1, if not 100 to 1, are the victims of violence, not the perpetrators of violence. And there's also no other area of medicine where we refer to the practitioner with a slang word like shrink. We call everybody else a doctor, but why do we call psychiatrists shrink? That really adds to the stigma that it's so shameful that you can't even say that you're seeing a medical professional, that you have to use a
Mary, can I interrupt you for a second?
I gotta push back a little bit here, Mary. I don't think anybody thinks all mentally ill people are potentially violent, because everybody at this stage of the game knows mentally ill people.
In
their families, in their neighborhood. I disagree with that.
But in Mary's defense, sometimes we leave it hanging. I think most of us in our heads don't think that, but I think most of us leave it hanging. And also, Mary, while I respect what you do for a living, I use the term shrink constantly, and maybe you're right that that's the impact, but as somebody who's seen a shrink from time to time, I sure as hell don't intend it in any. I call doctors docs. Is that disrespectful to primary care physicians?
That's not disrespectful. It's just that the fact that we don't use that a slang word in any other profession puts psychiatry apart. And of course, all of us might say that in conversation with each other, but to say it on public radio is a little different. There should be a different standard. And of course, you are educated and I'm educated, so that I don't have the stereotype of mentally ill people as violent. But the vast majority of people are not as well educated and don't know what you know. So therefore, when you're going to talk about mental illness and violence, it would be nice if there was a little preamble or a little explanation that we're not, you know, we don't mean to.
Okay, Mary, I hear you. Two things. One, we will take that, but with all due respect to your position, I think you are really unintentionally looking down your nose at people, as you call them, who are not as well educated. I think the vast majority of people in low and middle income society get it as well as we who are theoretically better educated, because as you know much better than we do, mental illness is everywhere.
And
this notion that these families don't get it, I'm sorry.
And middle income communities are gracious enough to open up their neighborhoods to halfway houses who treat the mentally ill, where people are able to live there. So,
do you agree, by the way, that now that she's said it, and considering she's a psychiatric nurse, I'm feeling like maybe I have made a mistake on the shrink thing. Is that, do you consider that to be a term that, and by the way, I've used the term shrink quite often with shrinks, with psychiatrists, and I have haven't had one ever say to me, I'm offended, or it's a demeaning way to refer to the profession or whatever. In any case, I will consider it. Let's go to Caitlin. You're in Worcester. You're our final call on this on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Caitlin.
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
Thanks for giving me a chance to speak a little bit. I was really interested in what Mary had to say. Also, I'm a therapist. I work with young children mostly. And, you know, one of the things that I noticed is parents and teachers, it doesn't seem like they have a lot of access to the mental health provider community. And it's been a really big concern for me. And I wonder whether, you know, if the role of the therapist wasn't a little bit more flexible, and if insurance companies paid us for preventative mental health care, what the world would look like. I imagine
Amen.
It would be a really different place. And certainly on my list of complaints and grievances.
Well, that's something isn't that an area where legislatures, including Congress, have to get involved? And while there's been
absolutely.
A big uproar over the Affordable Care Act and what the minimum threshold or in terms of the quality and comprehensiveness of the plan are, and obviously that sort of went by the wayside with the change that the president announced unilaterally a week or so ago, that's where they have to get involved and say every plan has to mandate that this kind of coverage is granted, including this preventative stuff. So I think you're right on, Caitlin. Thanks for the call.
And, you know, one last thing, hats off to teachers, because teachers do identify a lot of these problems in their students, even before the parents do in many cases, because parents sometimes have the rose-colored glasses on.
Well, next time you say, Marjorie, that some teachers make too much money, I was going to say, I'll say it, Mary, my apologies to you, teacher, social worker, shrink,
Jim,
surrogate parent, they are everything.
Jim, you always try to throw the teacher thing at me. It's not the teachers.
Oh, it's the teachers' union.
It's the union of the teachers.
Who have the temerity to actually represent those people so they get a decent paycheck.
Yeah, they're worried about the teachers and not worried about the kids,
well,
but we shouldn't discuss that today.
Worrying about the teachers in great part means the kids will have a better life in those classrooms.
Okay. Would you like to say how many times you've gotten the President's Award from the Teachers Association?
I only got
Jim?
It once, actually. I got it once. First, one of the only five people who ever got
it. We got to move on here. When we come back, we're going to talk about low T. And by that, we're not talking about turkey shortages. We're talking about low testosterone. Is this a real medical issue or a big pharmaceutical creation? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Marco Werman. There's this photographer in New York who meets refugees. He snaps their pictures the first night they spend in America.
There's these people that had a room like all the other refugees' families, but they...
The Somali family's talking about was afraid to leave the hallway of the hotel.
They had a room, but they just didn't trust that people would remember them once the door was closed.
What's it like checking in to America next time on The World?
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the MIT Museum in Cambridge, presenting a year of kinetic art with new exhibitions, programs, and the family-friendly Friday after Thanksgiving chain reaction. Tickets at web.mit.edu/museum. And Frontline, A Death in St. Augustine. See what can go wrong when police are faced with domestic violence allegations in their own ranks. Watch WGBH's Frontline, Tuesday at 10 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So if any men out there find yourselves feeling, I don't know, groggy, low in energy, a little moody, it may not be the tryptophan from your holiday turkey. It could be another T word at play, as in testosterone, specifically low testosterone. Listen.
I have low testosterone. There, I said it. How did I know? Well, I didn't really. See, I figured low testosterone would decrease my sex drive, but when I started losing energy and became moody, that's when I had an honest conversation with my doctor. We discussed all the symptoms, then he gave me some blood tests. Showed it was low T. That's it. It was a number, not just me.
Today, men with low T have Androgel 1.62% testosterone gel, the number one prescribed topical testosterone replacement.
Yikes. So is low T a medical condition, or is it something cooked up by Big Pharma? Joining us on the line for his take on low T is Art Kaplan. As you know, Art is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Hey, Art, nice to talk to you again.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Thank you for coming on. So Art, I'm a little suspicious here of all this low T stuff, or maybe it's just natural aging. Is this a condition, or what do you think?
Well, I think it is natural. It's the male version of hormone replacement for women.
Yeah.
And it's a real phenomena. It's certainly the case that people know that testosterone drops as men get older, but whether gels do anything much to replace function, whether taking treatments either get you back your sex life or reverse the process of aging more generally, I would say the evidence for that, not so great. Maybe for a small subset of people who really suffer extremely low T rates, kind of similar to the hormone replacement thing in women. But just as a general thing to be dabbing on yourself, that starts to be, I think, a little bit more money-oriented.
And the industry is huge. This has exploded in the last couple of years, has it not?
It has. So you can see the advertisements getting people to run in there and say, I've got this. You measure the number. That triggers the prescription. Doctors don't feel like fighting with the patient, nor do they have the time necessarily to say, hey, you know what? You have low T, but you also have high H. You're high on fat. Why don't we talk lifestyle here and get you running down the road a little more? That would probably help too. And then there's just another number which we can all look at, which is like you're 65. And there are going to be changes that are associated with that. Part of what goes on here, I'm sorry to say, is this, you know, 60 is the new 40 and 90 is the new 25 and this sort of talk. And
I'm hoping it is.
Yeah, well, keep hoping. Hope is good. I don't want to rob you of hope. But reality is, I think that's ideological. Boomers just grudgingly not wanting to give in to the phenomenon of aging. And I'm not saying we should go gentle into that good night, but the idea that we can sort of, I don't know, do pharmaceutical versions of cosmetic surgery to keep ourselves feeling like we were 30, I'm not buying it. Drug companies may want you to buy it. I'm not buying this.
We're talking to a medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. Well, Art, if it is a lot about a boomer's not wanting to get old, does it, I mean, they had the big estrogen study a few years ago, said that it wasn't such a great idea for other reasons for women to take estrogen. One of them was heart attack and stroke, and I guess it was a slight increase in breast cancer as well. There have been other studies since then. But is it a problem if you just, you know, want to have high T instead of low T? Is there any reason why not, if you just want to feel better about yourself?
Art, before you answer that question, since Marjorie asked it, we have the second half of that ad we played a couple of minutes ago that in part will answer Marjorie's question.
I know what's coming, but go ahead.
And then you can take it from there. Here's the other half of that ad.
Women and children should avoid contact with application sites. Discontinue Androgel and call your doctor if you see unexpected signs of early puberty in a child or signs in a woman, which may include changes in body hair or a large increase in acne, possibly due to accidental exposure. Men with breast cancer or who have or might have prostate cancer, and women who are or may become pregnant or are breastfeeding should not use Androgel. Serious side effects include worsening of an enlarged prostate, possible increased risk of prostate cancer.
Okay, enough of that. So what's the problem, Art?
Don't want hair on their chest. I think we can safely say that.
Well, case closed. There are a lot of side effect issues. Probably the nastiest is when you're playing with hormones in men or women and you're taking them and you have incipient cancers, hormones can cause them to grow. So that's a serious risk. That's a serious danger. Cancer rates go up as you age. So that's a tricky thing. I'd say, look, the way to approach this is a pharmaceutical intervention, not the first stop, the last stop. I'm not saying quality of life isn't important. I know that there are many people out there grateful for their hormone replacement therapy. I know there are many people out there grateful for their erectile dysfunction drug. I get all that. But it can't be the first intervention tried. It's got too much risk. When you're playing with hormones, playing with fire.
You know, this conversation sounds, at least to us, to me, eerily similar to the statin discussion that came out about what's the appropriate way to treat the cholesterol issue. Is it just to double the number of the people on drugs, or is it actually to change your lifestyle? But I don't want to get into that. What I learned in the last day or two, which I am stunned by but shouldn't be, so assuming that a drug has some appropriate uses that are approved by the FDA, while the manufacturer, the pharmaceutical company, can't, and correct me if I'm wrong, Art, I know you will, can't advertise other uses that are not approved by the FDA for that drug. A doctor can, because the FDA has no jurisdiction over the doctor. So if the pharmaceutical company doesn't get you, the uninformed physician may.
True. And here's the way it works. FDA basically controls the companies. They put a little pack, you know that little tiny, tiny print thing that if you were old enough to use this testosterone, you couldn't read that little insert thing that's in there? That's the message that the company is saying in terms of this is the side effects and this is who should take this. Then they're done. Your doctor has to get informed consent from you, and the FDA doesn't regulate your doc. So the doc can use things off-label or outside what's called the indication. Why that's so would take another hour, but it is so. So there's room there, sadly, for the doctor to say, well, I'm not paying that much attention to these guidelines. I think you feel better. I feel better. We're all happy. I'm going to give it to you, even though you don't strictly fit the requirements for it. Doctors stay popular sometimes by being quick prescribers, whether it's OxyContin, whether it's an erectile dysfunction drug without trying to figure out what might be the underlying cause, diabetes or bad relationships, or whether it's low T or something else that's going on. So you're right, and it's just the world we live in with a lot of autonomy for the doc.
You know, I am embarrassed to admit what I'm about to, but in the spirit of full disclosure here, at our former radio station, I would occasionally read some of these ads, but in my own defense, I think, before I did read some of these ads for a few months, I actually researched this thing and found tons of reputable doctors who had mm-hmm. good credentials who were saying this is a cure for all these low end, all these things, these, as you say, that are part of natural aging. So are they cooking the books? I know it's hard to generalize, but are they cooking the books knowingly because they're too close to the pharmaceutical industry, or are they cooking the books because they're just not well enough informed?
Well, first, I'd make clear in the previous segment, and now again, we have established you as a hack, a teachers union, a
doctor, right, exactly.
Pharmaceutical industry. That's off the table. We know where that is. Now, talking one hack to another, it does seem to me there's a little bit of both. The guys are out there pushing product, and when you have this direct-to-consumer ads, remember, nobody else in the world has this. So you sit there kind of sluggish and tired of watching your Patriots game or whatever it is, and, you know, you're not full of the energy you had at a younger age, and you go in and say, Doc, what do you think? He does the test. Boom, here comes the number. Before, you might have not worried about it, or, you know, nothing might have been done except the doctor saying, I think you're getting a little chubby there from all that couch time. So we're seeing both. The drug companies push it. They're definitely making a bonanza from it. There is a core of people, I think, who could use it, and they have to be supervised and carefully screened, but they can definitely benefit. There's something there from this drug. But too much marketing going on.
So how do you, what's your advice? Forget the doctors for the moment. Forget the drug companies. What's your advice for the person caught in the middle, the man?
Yeah, I'd say, you know,
here's the ads. What does he do?
Let's try the lifestyle change first. See how that goes. Use this as the last resort. Don't use it as the first stop.
You know, Art Kaplan, what does the research say about the, you know, the famous Viagra, Cialis, all these things you see advertised all the time? I often tell the story to Jim about going to Gillette Stadium a few years ago with one of my kids, my son, and it was nonstop. They had that ribbon Cialis ad going all the way around the whole stadium during the whole trip. And of course, your kids say, "What's that?" And then by the time they're 10, they know what it is.
Well, don't they run through the inflated Levitra thing?
Well, they did for a while.
It wasn't just an inflated Levitra thing. It was a little phallic, by the way.
Yeah, they came through. That's right. The Patriots, this is a while ago, they came through this helmet that was like a balloon that was blown up with a big Cialis or Levitra or whatever it was. And then after the Patriots ran through.
By the way, I have to just jump in here. I know we're short on time, but my favorite part of this was the guy throwing the football through the tire.
Yes.
I thought Freud was dead, but he went on.
Yes. But are those okay? I mean, they're not going to cause these terrible side effects, are they, or are they?
No, I don't think their safety profile has been very, very good. In fact, oddly enough, what they are is kind of a blood pressure lowering thing, muscle relaxant. So they have a good safety profile. But still, what I said before is important. If you have an underlying cause of what's going on there, you want to figure that out. You know, just want to pop a pill, that's treating a symptom, not necessarily the disease.
Okay, last thing from me. You're sort of a one-stop for us today on all ethical issues. It sounds like you actually heard Mary, the psychiatric nurse.
I did.
Who was admonishing me in particular. I don't think Marjorie committed this sin for referring to psychiatrists. And I actually use the term more broadly, people who aren't technically, don't have medical degrees, as shrinks. She says it creates, well, you heard what she says. It creates this.
I don't agree with that. I think the way to mainstream mental illness, the way to mainstream the importance of getting care is to be a little loose about this. I don't think shrink has that negative connotation or stigma to it. There are some other docs, I refer to surgeons as cutters. There's inside baseball about this.
How do they feel about that? I never heard that before.
They don't mind. It's just a kind, you know, there's a friendly way to open people through the door, and then there's a sort of put-down way, and I don't think shrink hits the put-down.
Okay, that's good. So you're vindicated, Jim.
Well, at least by Art Kaplan. Art, it's great to talk to you as always.
Hey,
thanks so much
pleasure.
For your time.
Have
talk
a
to
great
you soon.
Thanksgiving,
Happy
Art Kaplan.
Thanksgiving.
Art is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center, and he's also the co-editor of the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Okay, when we come back, it is time for Open Mic with Harvard Business School historian Nancy Kane. Is there a tech bubble? And if so, what will it look like when it bursts? That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
The Federal Reserve's stimulus program has been good for the stock market.
It was a record setter on Wall Street today. The major averages finished higher, and the Dow Jones Industrial.
But what happens when that program is scaled back?
We are so deep in experimental mode, there is no game plan that can help us.
Uncharted territory for the Fed, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Boston Ballet, presenting Mikko Niissanen's dazzling new production of the sparkling classic The Nutcracker, opening November 29th at the Boston Opera House, bostonballet.org, presented by State Street Corporation.
This is Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So if it looks like a bubble and floats like a bubble, is it a bubble? That's what New York Times writer Nick Bilton asks. Is there a technology bubble? Investors speculate that there is. Silicon Valley, of course, says not so. But seeing that Silicon Valley lives in a bubble of its own making, can you really believe them? Joining us to talk about the tech bubble and the Silicon Valley culture is Nancy Kane. Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hello there again, Nancy Kane.
Hello there.
Well, reading these stories, I'm just worked up into a frenzy because these zillionaires are taking over, you know, this, not just the Silicon Valley, but moving into San Francisco and people, the story about the 98-year-old woman who's lived in a rent-controlled apartment for 50 years is going to lose it because somebody wants to put in some snazzy luxury apartments across the street. So tell us what this tech bubble is and what it's doing to San Francisco and the surrounding communities.
So what did Twain say? The past is not dead, it is not even past. So this is this story, right? New, very powerful, important industry with lots and lots and lots of wealth created primarily through equity, right? Through financial markets, and not that the products aren't important, et cetera, but the primary driver of the wealth is the financial market, the stock market. Think railroads in 1890. Think steel in Pittsburgh in 1885.
Oh, yeah.
Think Newport in 1890. Think about other very important new surging industries that have locational centers that then, in a sense, sweep over the landscape, own the culture, creating lots and lots and lots of different kinds of inequality, even in the wake of great wealth creation. I mean, there's no question inequality spiked dramatically at the income and wealth level, as best we can measure it in the late 19th century, around industries booming and busting like tech, like railroads or steel or the early automobile industries. So I don't think there's a brand new story here. I think it highlights for us, right, the extraordinary, if you will, costs of creative destruction, right? For all the glamour and sizzle of, you know, all the Silicon Valley, you know, millionaires, for all the glitter and vicarious interest we have in the kind of wealth shown on a movie like Social Network, there's another story. There's an underbelly. There's an underside. And that is what this Times article and many others, including this article by George Packer in The New Yorker in May, that caused all kinds of ire in Silicon Valley, they're writing about what's the other part of this story. And that's an important aspect of what's happening right now in places like Silicon Valley.
When you say the other part of the story, I hope part of what you're referring to is that these are the most self-important people I've ever read about in my life. When Mark Zuckerberg comes out as the most socially conscious person in the crowd, we'll talk about him in a few minutes. There's this Google employee, when Barack Obama goes out to speak at one of the campuses in Silicon Valley, a Google employee is quoted as saying, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm not going to go to hear the president because what I do every day is affecting more important change than the president of the United States ever can. And by the way, that was not intended to be full of irony. This is what he and apparently a lot of his colleagues believe. This is not aberrational? You say this is history repeating itself?
I think if we could be in a smoke-filled room in one of J.P. Morgan's clubs, right, or on the Corsair, his great yacht, in 1906, I think we'd hear some of the similar kind of things. You know, one of my favorite rockers, a kind of second tier but brilliant singer and lyricist, Pete Yorn, has a song called Splendid Isolation. And these industries are characterized by, in quotes, splendid isolation, these moments. And, you know, we all have our villages and our tribes and things. But what we're talking about here is a little bit different because, you know, J.P. Morgan and his cronies, Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Ellison, you know.
From Oracle, the highest paid CEO
in America for more than 1 year, right? All of these people have enormous power. That's what makes it different than my tribe of horseback riders or my tribe of, you know, historians. These people have enormous power, not just wealth, but power. And so I think, you know, what do we as a society think about the responsibility, if you believe indeed there is any, that accompanies that kind of authority, financial and cultural and technological and economic. And, you know, history is pretty clear on this. History is pretty clear that societies where those in great power have owned the responsibility as part of the authority, as the counterpart or the balance to the authority, have done much better in all kinds of measures on a sustainable basis than those in which that has not been the case. So I think the real issue we're in some sense talking about less in the bubble case because, you know, your guess is as good as mine as to whether this is going to bust again. If you made me bet on it from an historical basis, I'd say yes. I mean, the railroads boomed and busted as a bubble industry, you know, 25 times between 1860 and 1885. And so why would we think that tech would be so much different? It really is, I think, a fair parallel. But that aside, I think this issue of What do those that, you know, end up with so much clout owe, if anything, I have my own personal sense of that, you know, what do they owe to the larger landscape, San Francisco, to the political process? I mean, most of these men that are quoted in the Packer article, and we're talking about men. This is not a diverse group
of
people.
That's a great point.
It's white men. It's white men. It's white men. Let me say it one more time. It's white men that we're talking about overwhelmingly in this world. What do they, in a sense, owe, right, to the polity?
And, well, their answer would be, we don't owe anything because our work product is our gift or what we give to the rest of society. Other people through the ages have given different things, but we have no obligation because we've already met it. Isn't that what they'd say?
I think, you know, I think a lot of them do say that. I think there are some exceptions. There are some people that take the role, you know, even someone like Reid Hoffman at LinkedIn. I mean, he or Mark Andreessen to some extent at Netscape and now at the venture capital firm that he runs that's so influential on Sand Hill Road. Some of these people think, you know, look, we've got an enormous amount of, you know, wind beneath our wings. What are we going to do with that? Not just for the specific aspects of policy that we think we want, like better visa policies for engineers, but also in a larger sense for educational standards in America, right? For job creation. I mean, Steve Jobs, you know, infamously said, Apple's not going to bring any of those jobs back from Asia. Well, Steve Jobs said that there may come a time when Apple needs to sing a different chorus. But I don't think a lot of that the incentive for that will come from within this community of tribal chiefs. I think it's much more likely to come from voter and consumer pressure.
But the one outlier, at least, and I'm I don't know this industry at all, and surely not like you do, the one outlier seems to be the one from a different generation, namely Bill Gates. I mean, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, or whatever, has given, I guess, billions of dollars to education.
So Zuckerberg gave him $100 million.
Well, Zuckerberg's the one out right, when he was in real trouble, by the way, when he was taking a lot of heat. A lot of people think that was basically to mollify the critics.
Still a lot of money.
But is Bill Gates the outlier when it comes to, for example, just pick one example, public schools, where most of the kids of these Masters of the Universe don't go to school? Is he the outlier?
So I think, again, forgive me for being so harumphy historical, but I think it's a little early for us to kind of know this with any kind of certainty. So you think about someone like Andrew Carnegie, right, who did an extraordinary amount for education and libraries and communities and culture, right, after some little wee problems like the Homewood strike, right, and a lot of labor dispute. But it was a while before Carnegie stepped in. It was a while before Morgan and the second generation, really, of Rockefellers started to make a huge difference in terms of the betterment of mankind. I have had a number of different encounters with Melinda Gates, not on a one-on-one basis, but in small group settings. She and her husband, I have seen them close on in several different moments, are extraordinarily impressive. I have to say, just for what it's worth, that Bill Gates looks like a much happier, much more kind of centered person, giving away his money effectively, you know, in a very, very conscientious, careful, studied way. You know, this is one of the most results-oriented philanthropies in the world. I mean, he and she, because she's as much of the brains, if not more than he is, behind the Gates Foundation and their staff, they are going to eradicate certain illnesses for good. Because not just because they have the money, but because of the way that they're assembling people and other resources in very targeted, milestone measured kind of ways to make progress. So I think he's actually a front runner, if history is any guide, to, you know, a person and their responsibility and their resources trying to make a mark on a bigger canvas than what's the market cap of my company.
Well, also, how old is Bill Gates? He's in his 50s.
I think he's in his mid-50s.
Mid-50s, and Zuckerberg is what?
28, 27, something.
You mentioned the guy from Netscape. What has the guy from Netscape done? Has he done something?
So Mark Andreessen is just a very active kind of spokesperson and, I would say, you know, kind of soup maker. He stirs up the broth and the vegetables in Silicon Valley around politics, around a larger footprint, around different kinds of possibilities for collective action other than who's going to invest in the second round for the next IPO.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that Andreessen and some others as well show signs of, if you will, thinking beyond the transactional. I use that word very carefully. The transactional, right, pitter-patter and rhythm and culture and energy of Silicon Valley. So I spent time in Silicon Valley. Marjorie and I were saying we're Stanford graduates. You know, I've been back. It's an extraordinarily transactional place. You know, it really is. And if you ask people about art and culture and poetry, they'll tell you about it in relation to a technology, to an app, to a digitized collection, to something that is not always marketable, but always comprehensible, primarily in terms of its technological, right, application or connection, which is kind of fascinating when you think about it. It's like saying, going to Pittsburgh in 1879, everything being about the Bessemer process.
Do you know this Peter Shea guy? You're a much nicer person than I am, Nancy Kane. That's pretty obvious. Here's this. There's a startup founder named Peter Shea, S-H-I-H. And I guess he's the poster boy for bad behavior. He listed on a blog or something 10 things he hated about San Francisco, which is basically pricing out almost everybody because all of these young zillionaires are moving in. He hates homeless people. He hates constantly PMSing about the weather and, quote, girls who are obviously fours and behave like they are nines. Convince me that he's the outlier. He's the aberration. Is he? I mean, the arrogance level in these pieces, the Packer piece in the New Yorker, some of these pieces in the New York Times, I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but the level of arrogance and sense of self-importance is to me, and again, you're the historian, is just, it's epic. It is nauseating. Is she an outlier?
I think we could probably parachute into some other places, you know, including parts of Cambridge, where we would, and I say that as someone, you know, as a long-term Cambridgian, right, where we would find similar
you're
levels
right. okay,
of being
fine.
Obsessed with ourself and arrogance. What's troubling? Here's what's troubling to me, so forgive my old world piety. What's troubling is that a lot of these people have, and they know it, just like a lot of folks in Hollywood and a lot of folks in Washington, a lot of CEOs, have extraordinary, you know, influence and reach. So it's, you know, you say something and it is broadcast, or you say something and it is tweeted, or you say something and it ends up in a very prominent, you know, communication channel. So is that really, I want to ask, how you want to show up? You know, women are fours but act like they're nines. That's so condescending. It's so treating people like, you know, like they're some kind of means rather than another person.
But aren't they all saying they're fours? If what you say is true and there's so few women in the hierarchy of Silicon Valley, then it seems to me all these young leaders are saying the exact same thing by their actions. They're saying they're all fours when it comes to brain power and creativity. He's talking about their bodies and their faces. Everybody else is talking about their minds and their creativity, no?
I think we want to be careful about saying, you know, condescension and frat boy behavior, you know, is something that Silicon Valley has some kind of patent on. I just think we are living in a society in which common courtesy and communal respect is in short supply, you know. So I think that we want to be careful about that. Having said that, again, this along with Wall Street. So let's talk about it this way, folks. One step back, put on the wide-angle lens. These are the two industries that lead our economy. They don't literally lead our economy in terms of, like, stock market activity and wealth creation. They lead our economy in terms of the kind of cultural and even, you know, motivational influence they have. So think about how many young people today start talking about an IPO or selling something to Facebook. These are two huge Goliaths on the landscape. Is this what we want to hold them accountable for? To girls that act like they're nines when they're fours? I think we can do better than that.
You know, Nancy Kane from the Harvard Business School, you were talking about before the comparison between, you know, the Vanderbilts, Carnegies, Rockefellers, and all those people that made enormous wealth earlier in our history. But one of the things that strikes me as different is because the wealth is spread around much more. You know, Twitter went public I think it was 1,000 millionaires or 1,600 millionaires were created and stuff like that. And people, and there was one Vanderbilt family, Rockefeller family, et cetera. And when you look at these, the impact of all this enormous wealth on a city like San Francisco or on a town like Palo Alto where we just lived, it is much bigger because there are many more millionaires.
Not in relative terms, though, Marjorie. So think about Harkness Commons, which is a very famous building in the Harvard Law School. It was built by Stephen Harkness. Stephen Harkness was one of those folks who was part of the, if you will, the analog of the Standard Oil IPO. Or think about South Florida. South Florida was largely created by millionaires that were made by Standard Oil. So the most common moment to compare this to, the one closest in rough kind of hue, is this amazing tech bubble of the late 19th century. Newport, right?
Okay.
You know, parts of Connecticut. Parts of New York. Think about what Fifth Avenue was. Fifth Avenue was a countryside, right? Remember Age of Innocence, that movie?
Yes,
the movie with Daniel Day-Lewis?
It.
And like they went to visit Granny and she was like at like West 57th and, you know, Central Park West. And there was nothing around her. She was in the country, right? So that was all populated by the equivalent of Twitter IPO millionaires. So yes, we've had those before. And in relative terms, I'm sure we don't have more wealth creation on a per capita basis than we did then. But what's interesting is just like then, perhaps even more so now, that wealth is actually very inequitably, very tightly distributed among a very tiny percent. So I just looked up income inequality, some very, very good numbers. So in 2012, according to the IRS, this is income, not stock market asset, right, creation, asset value. In 2012, the top 1% controlled like 24% of all income, a quarter of all the income made in the United States.
Wow.
We're just living in a time that is of extraordinary consolidation of money, both stocks and flows, you know, wealth and income in the hands of a very few people. So you add that to the kind of things we're talking about culturally, and we have something that suggests to me that it's not socially, culturally, you know, sustainable or stable.
Okay, we only have 2 minutes left. I want you to explain something to me. I know you're an historian, but you're at Harvard Business School, so I know you can explain this. Let's talk about just one company, because Marjorie started this discussion with, you know, is this tech bubble going to burst? And obviously a lot of people who have mutual funds whatever hope it doesn't. Snapchat. Let's just take that as an example. Snapchat, for those who don't know, is that, you know, you send the video pictures and they disappear in whatever X number of seconds or whatever it is. Okay. Snapchat was valued at $70 million 8 months ago. Today, you know what it's valued at now, 8 months later? $4 billion. Do you know how much revenue it has? Zero.
Yeah.
Could you, now in 60 seconds or less, could you please explain, or 140 characters if you prefer, could you explain to me how its valuation went from $70 million to $4 billion and how we're not at risk of a bubble bursting as a result of this kind of thing?
I can explain the first, but can't promise you the second.
Okay, fine. Take
so
what
the first is that in the intervening months, right, the market, partly because of Twitter, partly because of some other interesting and Facebook's recovery, the market for young technology company equity assets in those companies, ownership, whether they're public or private, you can still invest in companies, right? Has gotten very hot. Let's put it that way. So it's a little bit like when Vamp, you know, nail polish made by Chanel in the 90s got really popular and you couldn't buy it anywhere and the price went way up. Same kind of thing. So suddenly people will pay a lot more for a piece of paper that says you own one share of Snapchat, you know, stock in a private company. You can still buy, you know, preferred and common stock than they would 6 months ago. It's just like that. It's not about some kind of carefully calibrated cost-benefit analysis of the likelihood of this company making P-R-O-F-I-T. It's about a market with lots and lots of people trying to get in that's as much about fashion and sizzle and sensibilities. Keynes called it animal spirits as it is about anything else.
Okay, fine. You know what I'll do, because you're such a good person, thus I will not ask you whether or not I should continue to keep my money under my mattress. We'll save that for next week. Is that fair enough?
Fair enough.
Now, Nancy Kane, it is a favor to you, since you mentioned what your favorite song was. We're going to go out on it. Nancy Kane, great to see you. We'll see you next week.
Oh, this is great. It's called Splendid, I believe. Is that what
Splendid
it's called?
Isolation.
That's
sexiest
right.
Splendid rocker isolation. In the United States, Pete Yorn.
Okay. Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, if you can make your turkey as well as you can make these cookies and these pies you bring us, you're going to have a very, very happy Thanksgiving. When we come back, Grillmeister Stephen Reichlin makes the case that it's never too cold to throw a turkey on the grill. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Is a pathway to citizenship for 11 million undocumented immigrants simple?
We have equality and equal opportunity in our DNA as a country. And to exclude people from that opportunity, it's a cancer.
Activists say immigration reform is good for America. Conservatives in the House say it's not so simple. That's next time on The Takeaway from Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Mass Eye and Ear. When vision problems affect the way you experience life, experience the difference Mass Eye and Ear can make. Visit masseyeandear.org for more information. That's Mass Eye and Ear. And Merrimack Repertory Theater, presenting the romantic comedy Stella and Lou, asking if a second chance at love is possible for two people with a lot of miles on them. On stage November 29th through December 22nd. MRT.org.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. When it comes to grilling, it isn't just for summer. And when it comes to turkey, turkey burgers aren't the only things you can put on the grill. Joining us to talk about how you can grill a Thanksgiving dinner, wow, is Stephen Reichlin. He is a writer, a cooking teacher, host of the TV show Primal Grill. He's also written a novel entitled Island Apart. Stephen Reichlin, good to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you. How are you?
Great.
We are thrilled to talk to you. Stephen, before we get to the turkey, are you the chief cook in your house on Thanksgiving?
Well, this year it's going to be a collaborative effort. We have a large group of people, and my daughter has picked up that torch in terms of hosting it at her house.
Oh, great.
So we'll have dueling turkeys. Son-in-law is going to make my bourbon-brined maple smoked turkey. And I'm going to be going back to my French years in college, and I'm going to be making a French-style turkey with truffle butter stuffed under the turkey skin and spit-roasted.
What time should we get there, Stephen?
Yeah, I know. Well, 6 o'clock.
I figured if you are an expert, the pressure would be on, but I guess if you're with family, they understand you're going to make a great turkey. I hope your in-laws are good cooks, too, Stephen Reichlin. So tell...
My son-in-law does a great job. My daughter is the dietitian for the Miami Heat, so she always brings a little...
Oh, my gosh.
Twist of a little healthy twist, and as far as I'm concerned, you know, if you've got people you love gathered under your roof, you know... That trumps any food.
I hear LeBron is having 9 turkeys for Thanksgiving. Is that true just for himself? Is that true?
Yeah, right.
Okay. So tell us about this brined turkey on the grill that you think is the absolute best.
Well, it really originated with sort of an anatomical challenge to a turkey, and that is the breast meat cooks about a half an hour before the leg meat does. And so if you cook a turkey to a safe temperature for the leg meat, invariably you're sort of drying out the breast. So I've evolved various strategies for overcoming this. And one is brining. Brine is nothing more than a saline solution, salt, sugar, or maple syrup and water, roughly 1 cup to 1 cup to 16 cups. And what happens is by the process of osmosis, when you soak a turkey in a brine, some of that brine is absorbed into the turkey meat, which adds moisture to the turkey meat. Now, second step in that procedure is to use a technique I call smoke roasting. You set up your grill for indirect grilling. Ideally, you'll be working on charcoal because it's easier to smoke on a charcoal grill than a gas grill. The turkey brines for 24 hours. And then it smoke roasts at about 325 degrees, depending on the size bird. I like a 12-pound bird. And actually, if I have a lot of people, I like to cook 2 smaller birds rather than one bigger bird.
Why?
Well, I think you get better control, better heat control, better temperature control, less tendency to dry the outer meat out while you're trying to cook the inner meat.
So speaking of temperature control, you were talking about the turkey. Let's talk about human temperature control while you're doing this. On Sunday night, the Patriots played the Broncos, and it was something like 0-degree wind chill. How do you do that? Let's assume that's Thanksgiving Day when you're doing the Stephen Reichlin extraordinaire. How do you do that?
Well, I have to speak at that theoretically because you're talking to me down in Miami.
I'm okay.
A New Englander until the end of October, and then I become a Floridian again. But I think actually we looked at your weather report, and I think it's not going to be too bad on Thanksgiving.
No.
Although there might be some rain. Anyhow, you know, parka, wool cap. I mean, you know, when I lived in New England, I used to chip the ice off my grill in February and grill. So,
and the grill is warm.
You guys are tough up there.
Yeah, you're standing next to a warm grill, right?
You are. But interestingly, when it is cold, there are a couple things you need to keep in mind. And one is that because you're cold, you may think that the grill is also cold. But remember, fire is fire and it's hot and it can burn you. Second thing is... Never light a charcoal grill under a tree branch that is laden with snow, okay, because that could melt the snow and dump it on your head.
Now, okay, so let's get back to the grilling thing itself. A couple of things, Stephen. You first said is this, what do you call it, smoke grilling? Is that what
smoke roasting, yeah.
Smoke roasting. That's why a gas grill can do that at all. How does a gas grill even do that?
Well, a cast grill can't really do it very well, so that's why I was sort of dropping the hint for a charcoal grill, a charcoal kettle grill. On a gas grill, you can indirect grill, and to do that, you know, if you've got a 3-burner gas grill, you kind of light your outside burners or your front and rear burner and cook the turkey in the center. Problem with a gas grill is because of the venting in the back, most of the smoke goes pouring out. you know, there are smoker boxes, smoker chips you can attempt. But honestly, if you really want to be in this game for real, you want to invest in an inexpensive kettle grill to smoke your turkey.
By the way, notice,
I'm saying smoke roasting, not smoking, okay? Because true smoking is done at about 225 degrees, the so-called low and slow smoking. And you will get a delicious smoked bird, but you'll get rubbery skin. And for me, you know, it's like, give me the turkey skin and, you know, everybody else can eat the meat.
Well, you know, you point out two wonderful social aspects of doing it this way. I mean, even if it is going to be cold, you know, in the summertime, it's like the classic thing. We've talked about this before, Stephen Reichlin, when the men are out grilling on the porch, even though I suppose some women do it too. But they're sort of, you know, you're out there with your beer in hand and you're having your cocktails and you're getting outside. And also,
and you're complaining about the low temperature? I mean, to me, that sounds like paradise, whatever the temperature.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's sort of fun, and also the fact that the oven is freed up, because most of us don't have two ovens. We're not professional cooks. We got one oven, and the turkey takes up so much room.
Well, there's a third thing. Don't you also write that once you've done the brining and pop it on the Weber or whatever you're using, that's it. You just wait till it's done, right?
Well, I mean, in effect. In fact, you do need to replenish the coals every hour. You need to replenish the wood chips every hour. You know, you need to monitor the grill to make sure that you've got the right temperature. And by the way, if it's really cold there, you may need to use more charcoal than you normally would. You know, you are fighting the cold a little bit. But I think the important thing is for the taste. I mean, once you taste a brined smoked turkey you've made yourself, because it'll never, you know, it will be supernaturally moist. Once you have that experience, you know, there's no going back to an oven-roasted bird.
Well, you know something? You are right. I mean, I have to say, I'm not surrounded by great cooks in my family, and the turkeys are inevitably so dried out, you need to sort of sauté them in the gravy before you can even put them in your mouth. So this would be a wonderful experience. We're Irish, you know what I mean, Stephen?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Well, I've tried to make the process as painless as possible. And if you go up on my website, which is barbecuebible.com, that's BarbecueBible.com, you'll find three variations on a theme of turkeys outdoors. That brined smoked turkey I talked about, the turkey with the butter and the truffles under the skin that I talked about. And then a third one that's kind of unique down here in Florida, it's called a turkey adobo with mojo. It's a Cuban-inspired turkey. It was actually the first turkey I had when I moved down here. And an adobo is a marinade that's made with garlic and sour lime juice and salt and pepper and cumin. And it again, goes under the skin. And then it's sort of like a, could almost think of it like a dry brine, and it gives you an incredible flavor. But you know, I'm thinking we're so busy talking turkey that we shouldn't forget some of the other side dishes you can do on the grill.
Now Marjorie calls them fixins. Go ahead.
I'm gonna assume, even though you're Irish, you do have a half a dozen grills in your backyard, right?
Oh yes, many, many in the backyard. Absolutely, Stephen.
So what's the rest of the menu? Fill it out, Stephen.
Okay, so, well, one thing we're doing, you know, we have a fun twist on sweet potato casserole. So I have a style of grilling that's called caveman-style grilling, where you lay the sweet potatoes directly on the embers of a charcoal fire, no grill grate needed. And if you have a gas grill, you actually crank it up to high, and you can do this on a gas grill, but you char the skins of the sweet potatoes on the embers.
Ooh.
And they acquire this incredible smoky flavor. Then you just whack them in half, and you know, for the kids, you can put little baby marshmallows on them and let the marshmallows melt in. For the adults, you can make a maple cinnamon butter and put that on these ember roasted or fire roasted sweet potatoes. That is completely awesome.
Sounds
so
awesome.
Another thing we're doing is,
by the way, before you go to the next thing, what you need to do, Stephen, I don't know if it's conscious or otherwise, when you reach the point when you're about to sell the item, you lower your voice and it slows down a drop. So when you talked about putting the skin of the sweet potato directly on the charcoal, it was perfect. You really sold it, Stephen Reichlin.
Well, thank you. You know, I love caveman style grilling. I do it for steaks. I do it for sweet potatoes. It's really fun to ember roast the vegetables you use to make a salsa. I mean, first of all, you know, the flavor, the smoky flavor, the charring. But then the way, like if you watch, you know, when people watch you put a steak or a half a dozen sweet potatoes on the embers, they think, is this guy crazy?
Yeah.
I mean, it's what I call the eye pop jaw drop factor.
Yeah. Tell me one thing. It's too late. I know we're moving from the fixing for just a second, but it's too late if you haven't ordered it already. But you talk about ordering a heritage bird for the holidays. Yeah. Is one of your tips. What is a heritage bird?
Well, so 100 years ago, or even 50 years ago probably, turkeys were raised on farms, and they were raised for flavor. They weren't raised to have these grotesquely enormous breasts, and they certainly weren't injected with brine and had little pop-up thermometers in them.
Yeah.
And heritage birds are kind of more akin to what people would have eaten 100 years ago out in Old Sturbridge Village or Plymouth Plantation. The meat is a little tougher. It's much more flavorful than a commercial bird. And heritage turkeys are also raised much more humanely. They get to walk around and, you know, sort of scratch and feed in the grass rather than being raised in a big poultry factory. It's funny, we spend half the year on Martha's Vineyard, so we've got pals at the Farm Institute, and they brought our heritage birds down by plane for us last year. This year we're going to be eating organic turkeys from Whole Foods, and I believe that option still is open to people. And, man, you know, if you've never tried an organic bird, the flavor is completely different.
Well, we have the Whole Foods thing. I don't think anyone's flying us a heritage bird anytime soon. Can we go back to the I cut you off at the sweet potato pass. What else is on the menu for Stephen Reichlin?
Okay, so another thing that I love to do is we cut acorn squash in half through the equator, as it were, and they get indirect grilled on either grill rings or little rings of crumpled aluminum foil. And the sort of sweet and simple version would be you douse them you fill that cavity with butter and maple syrup and a little cinnamon and indirect grill the acorn squash until it's soft. And the vegetarian version, because, you know, every once in a while there are vegetarians that show up at our Thanksgiving feast, and we don't want them to feel badly. So then we would fill the squash with sautéed mushrooms, wild rice, sautéed onions, maybe a few cranberries, and fill the squash with that mixture. So, in effect, it becomes a protein-rich, very delicious, satisfying vegetarian entree.
Do you worry? You know, we're going to talk when we hang up with you. We're going to talk about whether people do the full splurge or they decide to strategize so that they don't become a balloon post Thanksgiving. Where do you fall on that spectrum, Stephen Reichlin?
Man, you know, I try not to overeat, but it's awful tough on Thanksgiving. That's just about a dozen of my favorite foods in one single meal. So. I am probably not a poster child for moderation on that day.
Good. Hey, before you go, I am really embarrassed that it took you to enlighten me about this. I never thought about this my whole life, even though I'm a big turkey fan. You wrote a piece about where the term turkey comes from, and it never occurred to me, as pathetic as it is, what the answer was. What is the answer?
Well, it's amazing, kind of, when you think about it, because here's a bird that was native to the Americas. The pilgrims ate wild turkey. How in the hell did it get to be named for a Muslim country in the Middle East?
Exactly.
It turns out, back in the 17th century, all of the prestige luxury goods and luxury foods enjoyed in Europe either came from the Middle East, and specifically from the Near East, specifically from Turkey, or else used Istanbul as that was the terminus of the spice route. And so, in effect, anything stamped with Istanbul, Constantinople, Turkey, that was the marketing term, you know, much the way that Tuscany or France or Provence would be a marketing term for food today. And so this American bird came to be labeled the turkey bird as a way of selling it. And it was a metaphor that was actually adopted by a lot of European languages. In French, they say dand, which is an abbreviation of from India, dand. Mm. And in Dutch and the Scandinavian languages, the word for turkey is a variation on Calcutta, Calicut. So, you know, even we're looking at a truly global food back in an age when, you know, it probably took a couple of months to get from the New World to the Old World.
That's a great story. I had no idea either. Thank you so much, Stephen Reichlin.
And thank you.
Yeah,
I sort of think.
Yeah.
I wish everybody a happy New England, and I got to say I miss your cold weather because I used to love putting on a sweater for Thanksgiving, and of course down here in Miami it's a lot different.
Anytime you want to switch places, give me a call, Stephen. Stephen Reichlin, thanks so much for your time.
Thank
Appreciate
you very
it.
Much. Have a great Thanksgiving. Somehow I think I would be eating a lot better at his house. I might be where I am eating, but that's okay. Stephen Reichlin is a writer, cooking teacher, and the host of the TV show Primal Grill. He also has a novel out titled Island Apart. Again, Stephen, thank you for joining us.
So as you just heard Stephen say a couple of seconds ago, he's not a poster child for moderation. What we want to know at 877-301-8970, as we continue the countdown to Thanksgiving, over the holidays, do you violate every nutritional guideline and principle? Do you abandon all self-control? I know it's a bad idea, but do you? Or even on Thanksgiving Day, do you exercise willpower and portion control? We want to know what your strategy and approaches. Now, Marjorie, I'm going to speak first. Before
you always speak first.
At 877-301-8970. Marjorie is going to mock my eating habits, but I would like to just say, Marjorie, the following. My new philosophy for weight control, whether it's Thanksgiving or not, is anything that has certain appeal to you, have a taste of. And that will satisfy, because here's a perfect example. Nancy Kane.
I was just going to mention that.
Say what Nancy Kane
Nancy Kane, our previous guest from the Harvard Business School, is not only a brilliant historian, she is a great cook.
She is incredible.
So today, she
and
brought
generous.
Us this. She is very generous. She brought us this unbelievably fantastic fudge pie, like a chocolate pie with Ghirardelli chocolate in it. Did I pronounce that right?
Ghirardelli.
Whatever it is. And fresh homemade whipped cream and berries. And we all dove in and had a big piece of pie.
What did I do?
Had a taste of pie, a little tiny sliver,
yeah.
Threw the rest out.
I didn't throw anything. I threw a little piece of crust out. But that is the
approach. I was so impressed.
My approach to Thanksgiving used to be, if I do not look like I'm about to give birth by Friday, then Thanksgiving has been a failure. But I have a new philosophy. My new philosophy is I'm not going to deny myself anything. I'm going to practice what I just preached with that chocolate
pie. It was beautiful.
If there's mashed potatoes like Marjorie makes them, for example, what are you putting them, cream and butter?
Heavy cream and butter.
The answer is you have a little dollop, as the saying goes. You have a taste. Don't deny yourself or you're going to be worse. You want a bite or two of stuffing, fine. The key, as it is the other 364 days of the year, and it is on Thanksgiving as well, it's some sort of portion control. That is the key. I used to be just like Stephen Reichlin. I was never the poster boy for moderation about anything. And now, at least for a very limited period of time, I am. 877-301-8970. What is your Thanksgiving eating strategy? Now, Marjorie, you've never gained a pound in your whole life, so you were the wrong person to be asking.
I did when I was in college, actually.
Well, other than that brief period of time, do you have a strategy? You don't even need a strategy.
This is going to sound like a stupid strategy.
Good. You eat all the mashed potatoes you can find, and then you go to sleep.
No, you just stop eating when you're full. You know what I mean? That's an
what?
Obnoxious thing to
what
say.
What is that?
It's an obnoxious thing to say, because I think that sounds obnoxious, but that's always
obnoxious.
Been my strategy.
For 34 years, I didn't know what full meant or not full meant is what I was really trying to say. 877-301-8970. I'm serious about this. People think I'm joking. Uh-huh. You need a strategy. If you don't have a strategy, you're going to wake up Friday morning and you're going to be really upset with yourself. And by the way, if you decide to go full throttle and you're just going to gorge yourself, that's fine. If that's a conscious decision in advance, it's not fine with nutritionists.
Well, I think you have to plan what you're going to wear to the Thanksgiving feast too. Diane White was a columnist for the Boston Globe, one of my favorite columnists ever.
The funniest women who ever lived.
She's young and thinking about becoming a reporter, and she had this great line about elastic waistbands. It's a sign that you've given up.
Exactly.
Now, if you go to your Thanksgiving feast with a pair of elastic waist pants or sweatpants on, then you know it's hopeless because you can just eat whatever you want. You just keep loosening the pants. But if you go with, you know, a pair of jeans that sort of fit a little tightly or a pair of pants that you have to zip up and that are snug, there's only so much you can do, Jim. You can't sit there at the Thanksgiving Day table with your zipper down. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yes, you can. I've done it many a season. Unbutton and just 877-301-8970. Marjorie's making fun of me because that's her little cottage industry. I'm telling you, have a strategy or you regret it. First of all, can I tell you what the key is?
A
key, besides portion control. It's something I know a lot about. So
I know, you've studied it. It's very impressive.
Never arrive hungry. A lot of people's philosophy on Thanksgiving is the following. Mm-hmm. Since I know I'm going to eat till I drop, what I'm going to do is I'm not going to eat anything all day. And so then I can really gorge myself. No, no, no. If you arrive hungry, then you're going to eat five times more than you intended to.
Okay.
Have a little dab of something as the day goes along. So have a little this, a little that.
You'll be having dabs and dollops.
I'll have dabs and dollops on my way to whatever it is, Thanksgiving.
Okay. And are you going to wear the pants with the buckle so that it's a little bit harder to really go crazy?
Actually, I'm wearing.
You're not going to wear the sweats.
I'm not wearing the sweats because I don't fit in my sweats anymore. But if I did, if I can get a new pair. No, I've told you, I have a whole new approach to life and to eating, and I do. I'm not going to make fun of this. I have all, which is portion. The reason we are the second fattest nation on earth, we used to be the fattest, Mexico is now number one, is because all of America is like the Cheesecake Factory. You ever been to the Cheesecake Factory?
Yeah, they have massive portions.
I've never seen portions like that, and that's the problem. The key is have a tapas kind of life, a lot of tastes, of a lot of things that interest you, whether it's Thanksgiving or not, and you'll survive and be healthy and whatever. Okay.
So dips, dollops, and grazing.
Yes.
Okay.
No, I do grazing in small quantities. Let's start in Roslindale. I really know what I'm talking about, Marjorie. Let me just trust me on this one thing. Okay. Ellen, you're first with Jim and Marjorie. Thank you so much for the call, Ellen. Hi.
Hi, Ellen.
I do know everything, as a matter of fact. I just want to say, Marjorie, that last comment about his belt and his belt buckle, I was embarrassed.
I'm sorry.
So was I.
I'm sorry.
I shouldn't be poking fun at Jim, but I've known him a long time, Ellen. You know what I'm saying?
Is he rotund?
No,
he's lost a lot of weight.
And I was really interested about your comment, Jim, when you said the whole world's a cheesecake factory. That's profound. I don't think a lot of people think about that.
That's profound.
Well, no.
But it's true.
When you think about everything that's there, if you really want to eat healthy, it's scary. I mean, you have to have a lot of money because everything out there is processed and on sale.
Well, Ellen, we've had that discussion before, and I have to say that, in my opinion, that was an accurate statement maybe 5 or 7 years ago. But on a serious note, the availability of things, even prepared food, that is healthy, that is almost in the same category as some of the cheaper things that aren't so healthy, it's much more readily available if people look. But I'm telling you, the key, forget my strategy. What's your strategy for Thanksgiving, Ellen, so you don't explode?
Strategy.
What is it?
Here's my strategy. Yeah. First of all, we sort of have like a tradition where we get up and we do exercise. Like maybe we'll go to the gym class where, you know, you donate a toy, or we'll go for a good walk. If that doesn't happen, however, then we hang out and we barbecue the turkey every year, as a matter of fact, just like the man said,
Stephen
with
Ruffling.
Charcoal, and we kind of hang out. But you know that in your head that you have a certain number of calories. I mean, you don't want to just gorge yourself until you're ill. I mean, I can't do that anymore. I'm too old, you know?
Well, so
you just look at the food and say, well, do I want the pumpkin pie that looks like it has like the store-bought crust, or would I rather have the pumpkin pie that looks homemade? Like, you know, you're not going to eat every single thing. You're going to be sort of selective because there's so much food.
As to be selective, Ellen, I agree with you, and thank you for the call, and small portions. I'm sorry to keep repeating it. You take a little corner off the pumpkin pie.
Just have a little bite of that.
Have a taste.
Delicious fudge chocolate pie that's sitting over there.
You know what you put on top of it?
The whipped cream Jim's taking it home.
Let me tell you something. When Ellen just said she'd go for a walk at the beginning of the day, 10 years ago, I'd go for a walk on Thanksgiving with a whole pumpkin pie with me. I mean, that is the problem. People think that Thanksgiving is an invitation to Really? It's believe me. Let's go to Portsmouth, Rhode Island.
That's the thing you say when you've eaten the entire turkey and all the mashed potatoes. What's the point? Stop eating. Just keep going.
Do you know when I was in college, remember Sara Lee frozen cakes when they were all the rage?
Yes, I do.
Not only would I eat a whole chocolate or banana cake, a whole one by myself. Talk about portion control. I couldn't even wait till it was defrosted. You remember in one of the great Woody Allen movies, he said he used to be so hungry that when he'd take a TV dinner, which was a frozen dinner, for those that remember, out of the freezer, he would lick it while it was frozen because he just couldn't wait. Let's go to Tom in Portsmouth, Rhode Island. You're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about Thanksgiving eating strategies, Tom. Take it away.
Hi, Tom.
Eat moderately. Enjoy your food. But I take a walk after Thanksgiving dinner or before Thanksgiving dinner. And maybe the next day, make that a part of your life. And I'm reading a wonderful book called Walkable City by Jeff Speck. He works in here, urban planning and health and exercise and how a city helps that.
Walkable City, is that what it's called?
Walkable City by Jeff Speck, S-P-E-C-K.
Yeah. We're going to try to get him. Tom, thanks for the recommendation.
That's why dogs are good. You know, you have to take the dog for a walk after the dinner. You know what I mean? Before the dinner, then after the dinner. And once you're going to do a lot of walking, Jim, with the dog. Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Jay in Dorchester. Jay, you're next on Boston Public Radio. What's your strategy for Thanksgiving, Jay?
Well, I just wanted to tell Marjorie about the turkey bag, because she was talking about dried turkey.
Have you ever used
a turkey bag?
What do you do?
You cook your turkey however you want to do it, and then you purchase from the grocery store a turkey bag that's like a oven-proof baggie.
Oh!
You seal it around the thing, and it's like you have a $4,000 steam oven.
Really?
I never even heard of that.
I'll have to tell that to the relatives.
Go ahead, Jay.
I had never heard of it, and, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, a friend told me about it, and we've been doing it ever since, and they come out incredible.
So wait a second, one more time. This is after you've cooked it, you shove it into the bag, and what is this?
Prepare the turkey the way you normally would, and before you put it in the oven, you insert it in a turkey bag in your roasting pan.
So you roast it in the bag?
Yeah, in the bag. So you go to, you know, your main, every grocery store has them. There's like two in a box, you know, $2.50 a piece.
Thank you.
Prepare your turkey, slide it in the bag, you seal the bag, six slits in the bag, and you have a steamed turkey in, you know, 3 hours, and it's incredible.
Jay, Marjorie, you understand, in the bag. I mean, you can do that.
In the bag. I get that completely.
Jay, thank you for the recommendation.
I'm
going to buy it. That is actually a fabulous idea.
That's a brilliant idea. Let me know how it goes for you, Jim.
Let's go to Jan.
Jan and Newton. Hi, Jan.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you.
I want to tell you a little bit of my strategy, which goes a little bit beyond what everybody's been talking about. Mm-hmm. Before every holiday for about a month, I start to burn 200 extra calories a day, however I can. That way, I've saved up all those calories, maybe lost a little bit of weight along
brilliant.
The way.
This is
so
brilliant.
So I've got a little space for the dollops and the dab, because no matter how frugal you and good you are about your Thanksgiving dinner, it's too many calories. You know, it's too easy to overeat, even if you stop eating when you're full and, you know, you're very controlled about that. So you just burn a few extra calories along the way, and then you have a few extra to spend on dinner.
So
that's
wait a second.
Very impressive.
What do you do to burn roughly 200 calories a day for the month leading up to Thanksgiving, Jen?
Well, you know, that's about, a quarter of a mile in steps, you know, that you add. Mm-hmm. So you do some extra stairs, you park your car farther away. While you're listening to the radio or watching TV, you jump up and down a step.
This is very grown up.
You can do a little jump roping, you know, whatever, you know, just find ways to take a little extra walk. Walking the dog, you know, a little farther, you know, an extra block than you usually do.
So is it safe to assume that when Thanksgiving comes after this preparation, you, like Stephen Raiklin, are not the poster woman for moderation? Is that how it goes?
Well, no, moderation is still important because the meal is laden with more calories than I would normally eat anyway. So this is just in preparation to, you know, enjoy it until I'm full, because I don't usually eat pie and sweet potatoes and stuffing.
Jan, with your plan, we only have 30 seconds left. Do you think you could still meet the challenge? Let's assume Marjorie invited you over her house for Thanksgiving and everything is cooked in heavy cream. Do you think you could make it through the day?
You know what? One day, just prepping a Thanksgiving dinner from 6 in the morning till midnight, doing the whole thing, I burned 3,000 calories. I usually burn about, you know, 2,000, so I burned an extra calorie. It was the bottle of wine that put me over the edge. Otherwise, I would have been all right.
Hey, Jen, happy Thanksgiving. Thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
When you're not much of a cook, Jim, a lot of butter and a lot of heavy cream. You know, you can't go wrong. It sort of makes almost anything taste good, even the dried turkey. Yes.
Could you promote tomorrow's show really quickly so we can go back to the chocolate pie?
Okay. I don't know what I am promoting. Oh, tomorrow we have Boston Globe editor Brian McGroy. And we also will talk to Thanksgiving TV traditions with Bob Thompson, which is going to be great. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our team, Chelsea Murrows, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, and John Parker. Jim, I'm very inspired by your approach here to Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. We're all inspired.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
And Jim will be dipping and dolloping his way off to his next endeavor. Thank you for tuning in. See you tomorrow.